Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This week's congressional hearings on the Boeing 737 MAX crashes brought several revelations, including a 2018 internal email written by a manager of Boeing's 737 program. "Frankly, right now, all my internal warning bells are going off," said the email. Congressman Pete DeFazio, Oregon Democrat, read more.
He was writing to the general manager, talks about workforce exhausted, schedule pressure. "I'm sorry to say I'm hesitant about putting my family on a Boeing airplane."
That from a Boeing employee. So imagine how hearing that felt to the family members of the 346 people who died in two 737 MAX crashes last October and this past March. Those family members were there over 2 days of hearing, sitting right behind Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg as he took questions like this from Florida Democrat Representative Debbie Mucarsel-Powell.
"Many of the families have asked for your resignation, and I have thought for a long time, I don't want to blame you, but at some point, you have to take full responsibility of the negligence of these two flights. And I want to ask you, are you going to be stepping down as CEO of Boeing?"
"Congresswoman, no."
"No."
So Muilenburg has no intention to step down, at least for now. But even if he did, that would bring only momentary accountability to a much deeper problem. For years, the American aviation industry has self-regulated many aspects of aircraft safety and development. And that power only grew with last year's reauthorization of the FAA, where Boeing helped write a bill that took even more oversight out of the hands of federal regulators. So this hour on Point, Boeing, safety, and industry self-regulation. And we want to hear from you. Do you know how much regulatory power on aircraft safety still rests with the FAA, or how much has gone to Boeing? Some of the most knowledgeable aviation engineers work at Boeing, so shouldn't they be able to flag safety concerns first? Or is this an example of the serious downsides of industry self-regulation? Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today is Natalie Kitroev, reporter for The New York Times covering Boeing and aviation safety. Natalie, welcome to On Point.
Hi there.
So first of all, tell us, what do you think were some of the most important revelations from these 2 days of hearings that Dennis Muilenburg had to face?
Well, what we saw over the last 2 days is a number of new pieces of evidence that have come to light that together add to the sense that the aircraft manufacturer was at least aware of potential concerns with this plane before either the first or the second crash. As you mentioned at the top, there's this email from someone who works on the 737 line that's saying, "Look, employees are fatigued. I am concerned that they're cutting corners, possibly." Also in 2018, revealed yesterday, Boeing employees looked at this system and they said, "If it malfunctions and pilots take more than 10 seconds to respond, to intervene, the results could be catastrophic," meaning the plane could go down. And in June 2018, that's months before the first crash. So that's pretty interesting. I mean, that's a significant finding. The other document that we saw yesterday was a 2015 document. Again, now this is 2 years before the plane was cleared to fly. And in that document, a Boeing employee is raising questions about the fact that this system, MCAS, that contributed to both crashes, can trigger based on a single sensor. And what the employee says is, "Well, aren't we vulnerable here to possibly a single point of failure?" And from what we understand about both crashes, that's precisely what happened. This system triggered based on a single erroneous sensor. And so, you know, together, again, we have begun to learn more about how Boeing employees internally were wrestling with possible concerns about the 737 MAX.
And these aren't just, you know, run-of-the-mill concerns. These are sort of core system functioning concerns here, Natalie. I mean, did we learn from the testimony, from the hearings, whether, if and how Boeing reacted when employees raised these issues?
Well, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg has said, you know, that these concerns have been taken seriously, that they were addressed, and that they were considered. And I will say, you know, in a company like Boeing, you know, engineers often have robust debates about various different systems on the plane, you know, and mm-hmm. it's common for people to raise questions. And so, you know, at the moment, it may have just been seen as part of the natural process of putting this thing together. But I think the answer to your question, Meghna, is no. We didn't really get a sense of why Boeing didn't act sooner based on some of these concerns, which in retrospect, as you said, do look very significant. And Mr. Muilenburg yesterday said flat out, look, if we knew what we know now, we would have grounded the plane before the second crash. That wasn't enough for lawmakers. Lawmakers were saying, you did have some of this information. And so that is still a point of tension.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more then about what Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg knew and when. Because there's this moment here where before the Senate where Senator Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi, asked Muilenburg when he first became aware of messages from a former test pilot, these are text messages, suggesting that there were issues with that MCAS system and that he had, quote, Jedi mind-tricked regulators into missing them.
As I recall, I believe it was prior to the second crash
prior
earlier
to the second
this
crash.
Week.
Can you see that this raises much concern about the level of coziness between Boeing personnel and FAA regulators?
I can tell you that the comments, the values, the approaches that are described in those emails are counter to our values.
Okay, so Natalie, what exactly are they referring to here? And if Muilenburg knew about this before the second crash, how do we square that with Boeing saying that if they had known more, they would have done more?
So the messages are, first of all, Congress recently got their hands on these messages. That's why they're just coming to light now. These messages are instant messages between two pilots, one of whom is the chief technical pilot on the 737 MAX. And he's really the one that is leading the conversations with the FAA about what pilot training is going to be on this plane. And what he is saying to his colleague is, I'm basically having trouble with MCAS in a flight simulator. This is a giant machine that's used for tests. It mimics the conditions of flight. He's saying MCAS is running rampant on me. And he seems surprised by what's happening in the simulator. And he goes on to say, I basically lied to regulators unknowingly.
Right.
And what the Times revealed in an investigation earlier this year mm-hmm. is that this pilot, his name's Mark Faulkner, he, months before these messages, had asked the FAA to remove mention of this system from the pilot's manual, and he portrayed it as a system that would rarely activate. Now, what we know is that in the meantime, that year, Boeing expanded this system, made it more aggressive, and allowed it to operate in all conditions of flight. So what is possible and what the senators were getting at is that Mr. Faulkner is there in the simulator experiencing trouble with MCAS that maybe is more aggressive than he thought it was. And he says, I'm concerned that I may have misled regulators. Now, we don't know that's true. His lawyer has said all he was saying was that there was a problem with the flight simulators. But that's what the senators are getting at. They're saying, wait a minute, this guy, months before the certification of the MAX happened, months before it's cleared to fly, he's saying, I'm having trouble controlling the plane with MCAS going off in the simulator. And what they're saying to Mr. Muilenburg is, if you found out about this earlier this year, before the second crash, why didn't you act on it?
How did Muilenburg respond to that very important question?
So he said, look, I was made aware of these messages, but I didn't delve into the details. And that's really where the senators, especially Senator Ted Cruz, really laid into him. And what Ted Cruz said was, you're the CEO. Why didn't you get into this immediately? Why wasn't this a hair on fire moment where you demanded to know what was in there and tried to figure out what was going on? Now, Boeing has said, look, we have tried to talk to Mark Faulkner. He no longer works at Boeing. He's a pilot at Southwest, but he has not talked to them. And so they say they don't know what was in the messages. But again, this is a point of tension, right? Because what the senators were saying is, you know, you should have made it your business to know. And so, you know, it's an open question right now. And really what Boeing says is we don't know what he meant mm-hmm. in the messages at all.
Well, again, the timing of all this is what makes it so urgently important, right? Because we're talking about what Muhlenberg knew after one of their planes had already gone down, killing so many people. But I just, you know, we're talking about these text messages between Mark Faulkner and a chief technical pilot for Boeing. Ted Cruz, Senator Cruz, actually read some of those text messages out loud. So for listeners, I just want to give them a sense as to what you're talking about, Natalie. So here's Senator Cruz reading these instant messages that went between Mark Faulkner, chief technical pilot for the 737 MAX, and chief technical pilot Patrick Gustafson.
Mr. Faulkner, oh, shocker alert. MCAS is now active down to M2. It's running rampant in the sim on me. At least that's what Vince thinks is happening. Gustafson's response, oh great, that means we have to update the speed trim description in volume 2. Mr. Faulkner, so basically I lied to the regulators unknowingly. Gustafson, it wasn't a lie. No one told us that was the case. Faulkner, I'm leveling off at like 4,000 feet, 230 knots, and the plane is trimming itself like crazy. I'm like, what?
Senator Ted Cruz there reading some instant messages about what test pilots and engineers and Boeing itself may have known about the 737 MAX aircraft before two planes crashed late last year and early this year. We'll come right back and talk with a pilot when we take a quick break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Boeing, about airline safety, and about industry self-regulation. This is coming on the heels of 2 days of congressional hearings where Boeing CEO Dennis Muhlenberg faced members of the Senate and the House with the latest on what we're learning about what Boeing knew about the 737 MAX aircraft. I'm joined today by Natalie Kitroev. She's a reporter for The New York Times covering Boeing and aviation safety. And we're going to talk in a little bit about Natalie's terrific reporting on further reductions in the FAA's regulatory oversight power. But joining me now is Captain Larry Rooney. He's with us from Seattle, Washington. He's president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, a trade association representing over 30,000 professional airline pilots at 14 airlines. He himself has over 18,000 flight hours as well. Captain Rooney, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hello, Meghna. How are you? How are you today?
I'm doing well. So we talked to you about a year ago last when we checked in on the story of Boeing. What is your reaction to what you've been hearing coming out of these congressional hearings?
Well, certainly a lot of information has now transpired that we were not privy to back a year ago with regard to the concerns that existed internally to the Boeing Corporation with regard to the design of this aircraft. More importantly, the way that this emergency manifested itself with the crews was something that was certainly much more complex than what we had originally been led to believe.
Meaning what?
Well, originally we felt that this was a singular malfunction, meaning the MCAS created a situation where the trimming of the airplane was very aggressive. But what we're finding out now, you know, as this investigation has proceeded, that these two events, the one that we do have the accident report on from the Lion Air crash, and we're still waiting on the Ethiopian accident, but we suspect that it'll be very similar, are the NTSB had weighed in earlier this month and showed that the crews in both of these were dealing with a tremendous startle effect, for one, mm-hmm. and that the non-normals that they were dealing with, the emergencies in this case, were not simply a trim runaway, so to speak, but also an unreliable airspeed and unreliable altitude indications. So they were dealing with a plethora of emergencies. From a human factor standpoint, it would be very easy to get overwhelmed.
And so the implication being that because crews weren't trained or didn't know that these could be possible emergencies, that amplified the effect of them being overwhelmed and couldn't respond. They didn't even have time to respond, did they?
They had a very short window with which to regain control of the airplane. The system itself that was on the airplane, the MCAS system, presented itself suddenly, aggressively, and I'm sure it was quite terrifying for the crews, you know, that were dealing with this non-normal or this emergency situation in this case or both of these cases. So the ability for a crew to be able to coordinate their response would be one that was really human factors related. The crew's training would have to really stress the prioritization of the non-normal methodology that they would follow in order to extricate themselves from this. I mean, it goes into, you think about the Miracle in the Hudson accident where you had Captain Sullenberger and Skiles were able to extricate themselves from that because they had a very high functioning human factors training behind them so that they had a way to attack a problem that really had no rule book to follow.
Mm. Captain Rooney, let me ask you, you heard before the break, we played that tape of Senator Cruz reading some of those messages between the technical pilots at Boeing. I mean, would you like to have known that Boeing at any time in the development process for the 737 MAX, identified these problems with the MCAS system?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the last line of defense is the crew of the airplane. The crew should never be left in the dark with regard to systems knowledge that the manufacturer is aware of. It was quite startling to me to read through that transcripts to the takeaway that I felt was that the crew, the test pilots were unaware of some of these systems. If the test pilots were unaware, then, you know, where were the regular line pilots included in this? And they weren't. And this has been our biggest point of contention is that going forward, line pilots need to be part of the process, not just to get the 737 MAX airborne again, but in all phases of airplane design and development.
And that is not currently standard practice, Captain Rooney?
It is not. It is normally done by test pilots that are employed by the corporation. The actual beta testing to include line pilots is something that, you know, is going to be part of this return to service for the 737. But we believe that this needs to be part and parcel for all airplane designs going forward because you can see the importance of having regular people, regular line pilots, faced with whatever this non-normal is to see whether or not the system, in fact, is one that a normal crew would be able to handle.
Captain Rooney, when we had you on last year, you were one of my favorite guests of the year because you're so competent, and so steady here and so knowledgeable. But I just wonder, do you feel a little shaken? Does your faith in Boeing and the aircraft that you fly, does it feel a little shaken after what we've learned in the past couple of days?
Well, I mean, I think that we've lost trust in the process that we have, you know, believe that was one that put safety above everything. At this point, I think we obviously are going to get back there, but I think that we've taken a turn that is not a good one, and that Congress has, you know, weighed in very loud and clear that that this cannot happen again. I mean, we certainly owe this to the 346 souls that were lost in both of these accidents. The work that we do going forward here needs to provide meaning to the terrible tragedy that these families are facing.
Mm. Captain Rooney, stand by here for a second. Natalie Kitroff, you've been really patient here in listening to my conversation with the captain. But I wonder, you just heard Larry Rooney say that he and his fellow airline pilots would have liked to know that at some point, or at least now possibly multiple points in the development of the 737 MAX, that issues were raised with the MCAS system. And yet they didn't. So, I mean, How is something like that allowed to happen in terms of what Boeing is required to report to federal regulators?
Well, Boeing's defense here is that they said that MCAS, the way that a malfunction of this system would present to pilots, would look like another emergency situation that they are, you know, trained to deal with as a memory item. So run through this emergency procedure. But what Captain Rooney points out very eloquently is that the pilots on both of these flights were inundated by a cacophony of warnings as this thing is going off. What the NTSB found was that Boeing underestimated the chaos in the cockpit, that there wasn't a consideration, the NTSB said, of just how overwhelming it would be when you have all of these things happening at once, and that, you know, the pilots on these flights became inundated. And so, you know, a big point of contention, and one where Boeing has really said, you know, we erred, we made a mistake, has been the fact that Boeing really never told the pilots that this system even existed, let alone how to deal with it. And so, you know, I think Captain Rooney speaks for a lot of pilots that I've been talking to when he says, we need to know that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Captain Rooney, there's so many other detailed questions I want to ask you because of your experience in the cockpit here. What about Natalie kicked us off this hour by telling us that one of the major revelations was that that we now know that people had raised red flags about this single point of failure problem with the MCAS system. I mean, to me, I had always presumed that it was sort of a bedrock presumption in aviation that you had to have redundancy in systems because when something goes wrong, it could be catastrophic. Did that surprise you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been our bane with the manufacturer since that revelation came out. The reality was that any type of a system on the airplane, I mean, any system that's built into an airplane invariably has a backup to the system. Unfortunately, in this the MCAS situation, we were not aware that the MCAS even existed on the airplane, and when queried as to what the backup was to the MCAS system, the response was that we were. Well, how can you be a backup to a system that you don't even know that's on the airplane?
When were you told that?
This was when Boeing met with the Allied Pilots Association. It was over a year ago now, I believe.
Over a year ago. So was it it was after the first crash?
It was. I believe that's, yes, it was.
Okay.
And I believe that is the case.
So just to be sure that I heard you correctly, when airline pilots asked Boeing about this, about what would be the backup to a system that you didn't even know exist, Boeing told you, you're supposed to be the backup.
That's correct. That was what was transposed to the Allied Pilots Association members that were there at the time, that they were the backup, that the pilots would be the backup to the system, and that the system didn't have its own backup to itself.
Okay. Natalie Kitroff?
Highly irregular.
Yeah, that does sound highly irregular, Natalie.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the crux of it, right? It actually goes to the core of the design of this system. Boeing, and this comes from, you know, investigations, you know, including that NTSB investigation. Mm-hmm. Boeing assumed that pilots would intervene almost immediately when the system malfunctioned. And that assumption, we know from our reporting, was baked into its own safety assessments, its own, you know, risk assessments of this system. And so that erroneous assumption guided the development of the plane really from start to finish. And, you know, the idea that, you know, pilots were going to be the backstop, that is a big part of how we got here, right? You know, there was this overwhelming, I think, you know, now even Boeing would say overly optimistic assessment that when this emergency presents itself, pilots will go to their rote, you know, will go immediately to their emergency procedures and they'll counteract it, cut it off. The system will stop activating. That's not what we saw. What we saw in both accidents was pilots struggling against, wrestling with this nose down movement until both planes, you know, entered fatal nosedives.
Okay, so Natalie Kitroev and Captain Larry Rooney, hang on here for just a second because I now want to bring into the conversation Mike Perrone joins us from Washington. He's national president of the Professional Aviation Safety Specialists, a union which represents FAA inspectors, technicians, engineers, and others. He's worked for the FAA for over 30 years. Mike Perrone, welcome to On Point.
Hello, and thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Mr. Perrone, ideally, what role are FAA regulators and safety inspectors supposed to play in the development of an aircraft like the 737 MAX?
You know, the FAA inspectors, their entity is to be the regulator, oversee the industry to make sure from the ground up that anything that is done properly and with, number one, safety is in mind, not profit, not schedules, but the safety of the flying public. And our inspectors, you know, they come from industry, many of them, so they have a background in flying and mechanics and so forth. So they know what's going on. They come to the agency because they believe in the regulatory process that, you know, maybe they're tired of flying, the crazy hours that pilots have to do and so forth. But they come over to the regulatory side because they want to see the industry stay safe as possible. Mm-hmm. And we have the gold standard in safety.
Well, so, I mean, I'll turn the question to you that I asked of Natalie, that it seems like an emerging sort of repeated line of inquiry is how could have all of these red flags been raised by certain employees at Boeing, but because of the regulatory structure, I mean, because of, I don't know how much Boeing is allowed to self-regulate, those red flags were never shared with FAA regulators. I mean, is that kind of par for the course these days?
Yeah, exactly. That's something that, you know, past we have for a long time. 2003, I think, was the first time we testified in Congress about the organizational designation authority. It gives the industry, such as Boeing, and the regulatory and oversight function that would be normally the FAA's job. And a lot of it is because, okay, the agency can't get people, they can't get inspectors, they can't hire them fast enough or keep them because, like right now, the industry is doing very well, so they're paying better. But the FAA decided in transition to the regulatory side, which should be their main focus, to giving it to the industry. A lot of pressure from industry saying the FAA's, you know, slowing us down, they're holding us up, we can't get planes built and certified because the FAA regulatory side is slow. Well, at the end of the day, safety should be the number one concern. If it takes a little bit of time and it takes some time to make sure it's right, then so be it. But the agency has decided to move from what used to be enforcement and compliance to gathering data. So our inspectors right now typically will sit back in wherever they're working in the country and reviewing data that's given to them by the manufacturers, by the aircraft. So they have to rely on that information being proper and correct, and all our inspectors do is sign off on it. So if they don't know somebody is misrepresenting it or doesn't properly write the data up, our inspectors have no way. They used to go out and kick the tires, visit facilities, visit with the folks and see them on a much regular basis. Today, that's limited for a lot of reasons.
Yeah. Well, Captain Rooney, let me get your reflection on that. How do you see the checks and balances in aviation safety or regulatory aviation regulation right now?
Well, we believe that they're out of balance right now, that we believe the system failed us at this point. It's important, you know, to have the best people looking at the airplane designs, whether that's somebody from the manufacturer or somebody from the FAA. But historically, what we have depended on is that, like a teeter-totter, that the system is balanced, that the regulators are there to regulate the people that are, you know, making the final check mark to ensure that the system is a safe one. And what we've seen now is that that balance is not there, that whether or not the FAA cannot hire enough people to provide this oversight function, I guess that's a topic for another show. But the reality is that we feel that that balance needs to be brought back into the industry so that both parties have the ability to weigh in, and that the regulator has the final authority to be able to determine whether or not the manufacturer has, in fact, met the standard for safety.
So, Captain Rooney, we have to take a quick break. There is one more question I want to ask you. Can you hang on across the break here for a couple more minutes with us?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Captain Larry Rooney and Mike Perrone and Natalie Kitroff, stand by here. We are talking about what we have been learning about the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft, but also this much bigger picture about aircraft manufacturers and self-regulation. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Boeing, about aircraft safety, and about industry self-regulation. This comes on the heels of 2 days of very intense hearings in Congress where Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg faced a lot of questions about what the company knew about problems with the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. I'm joined today by Natalie Kitroff. She's a reporter for The New York Times covering Boeing and aviation safety. Mike Perrone is with us. He's national president of the Professional Aviation Safety Specialists, a union which represents FAA inspectors, technicians, engineers, and others. And Captain Larry Rooney joins us as well. He's president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, a trade association representing over 30,000 professional airline pilots. And he himself has more than 18,000 flight hours in the cockpit with American Airlines. Captain Rooney, before I have to let you go here, two quick questions. One is, before the break, you had been telling us about the fact that line pilots want to now be part of the process of aircraft development. That would be a significant change from just Boeing's test pilots getting their hands on these airplanes before they're fully developed. Is Boeing open to that idea?
Well, at this point, we anticipate that the plan for return to service will include just that, that pilots at varying experience levels, you know, those that have a lot of experience in the cockpits, and then some of those that don't have quite as many flight hours. Remember, the United States, we're blessed because the U.S. standard for pilot qualification requires a lot more hours, flight hours, than might exist in foreign countries. So our return to service, you know, will assume a higher standard with regard to pilot experience than perhaps might exist in countries that follow a more of an ab initio type program into the cockpit.
But this is for the MAX, though. I mean, what about future aircraft?
Well, for all aircraft,
okay,
that pilots need to be part. Line pilots need to be part of this process because we need to design for the average person, the one that doesn't live as a Czech airman or test pilot does in the world of non-normal emergencies. This is where this is so important, that this is included going forward. And, you know, one thing I would like to say is that the airplane itself, the 737, for your audience today, is an extremely safe airplane. Unfortunately, we've got the system that we're dealing with today, but, I mean, since the mid-1960s, this airplane has a very long, successful track record of safely getting people from point A to point B. And I know that with the process that we're undergoing right now, that we're going to make that airplane even safer.
So you'll have confidence in the 737 MAX if and when it comes back online?
Absolutely, because we will be part of that process. So, again, as I said earlier, the last line of defense is the captain's signature on the release who buys the airplane to take you to your destination. If he's not happy, the airplane doesn't move. And it's important that that individual, meaning that line pilot, has the knowledge with which to make that decision.
Okay, one more question, Captain Rooney, but how can you trust Boeing, though? Will you be able to trust Boeing? Because at the heart of this issue right now, as you were telling us, is that they didn't even tell you beforehand about certain, you know, changes that they'd made to the airplane. Are you confident that we'll come out of this situation with a company who, by virtue of oversight, federal oversight, is going to be more forthcoming about these things?
Well, I mean, this is what we're hoping, and this is what Congress is now, you know, grilling Boeing on as well, to ensure that going forward that we have, you know, taken a new leaf with regard to inclusion for the people that will be operating these airplanes. So I'm hopeful, but I can't speak for, you know, what Boeing will or won't do, since I'm not the CEO of Boeing.
Well, Captain Larry Rooney is the president of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association with us from Seattle, Washington. That's Boeing territory if I've ever heard of it. So, Captain Rooney, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on today.
It's great to have you back, Captain. Okay, so Mike Perrone and Natalie Kutroff, this now is sort of, we're definitely deep into the big picture of industry self-regulation here. Natalie, can you just describe to us, there was a bill that was passed in 2018 regarding just how much oversight companies like Boeing would have over themselves. How much do they have?
So for years, the government has been handing over more and more responsibility to manufacturers as a way of reducing bureaucracy. So, you know, the FAA has a limited number of employees. A company like Boeing has, thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands, and a lot of expertise. And, you know, the idea is that the premise here is that the company values safety, which I think we all believe that it does, and that they are the ones who really have the expertise to help approve a lot of these planes. But last year, this law was passed that really took this system, it's a system that's called delegation, or as Mike said, Organization Designation Authority, mm-hmm. ODA, to a new extreme with these paragraphs that really cemented a new power balance for industry. It allowed manufacturers to directly challenge government inspectors by automatically elevating any disputes that cause delays to their managers. And it made it really difficult for the FAA to pull back and intervene when it had given a manufacturer responsibility for something. It said, if you want to do that, you have to conduct an investigation or an inspection. That could be a really lengthy process. And so when this law passed, that Mike's union had a really stark warning. The group said this is going to turn the FAA into a rubber stamp, mm-hmm. and that it would only be able to intervene after a plane crashed, and I'm quoting here, and people are killed. 4 weeks after this law passed, the first 737 MAX crashed. Now, this law wasn't involved in the MAX certification. The MAX was certified under old rules. But those old rules are less permissive, are give away less to industry. So these new rules take it even further.
Okay.
And so the question has sort of been, what do we make of that in the wake of new revelations about weaknesses in the oversight of Boeing.
So, Mike, you represent inspectors, technicians, engineers at FAA. How far does this 2018 rule deviate from what your union believes is in the best interest of public safety?
Well, again, I think it's Natalie said, it gives the rubber stamp to the industry. We, unfortunately, at the time that bill was being worked on up in the Hill, we were fighting privatization of the air traffic control folks that we represent, the ATO. And we try to spend as much time giving lawmakers our input. Again, we've been doing this for many, many years, decades, to say the expansion of this program is not in the best interest of public safety, and our inspector workforce needs to have the regulatory oversight and final word. But because of the privatization piece, we were not involved in some of the discussions. We were not invited to some of the congressional staffers' meetings to give them our opinion because we were fighting the privatization and they were for it. So the political piece of that caused us to focus on getting privatization off. We believe, past beliefs, that the agency and Congress should tell them to take a breath, stop, don't expand this program. Let's take it and look at all the information that's out there, what's going to be out there in the investigation, and decide with all players involved, what's the next step? Do we pull back a little bit? Do we, you know, rescind the law? Not saying the ODA program should just go away completely, but it needs to be taken a look at because people died and you know, the aircraft had an issue. Our inspectors were not there to look at this and to sign off this the way they should have.
Okay. So, Natalie, the depth, though, of the industry's involvement in passing this law, I mean, specifically Boeing, is, I mean, perhaps it's not out of the ordinary in this day and age in terms of industry involvement with bill writing here. But as you reported in the Times that there were suggestions that companies ought to have input on performance evaluations for individual FAA employees or perhaps even have in a say on their compensation so that that members of industry would reach that far into how and what FAA inspectors do?
Yeah, I mean, our investigation, and we talked to 50 people who were involved, regulators, you know, lawmakers, congressional aides who were involved in this law. And what we found was industry really shaped the language of this law and did kind of overcome existing criticism from regulators and from some FAA employees. And we did see some of that. I mean, we saw, you know, there was in the law that actually passed, there is, you know, it gives the ability to a panel that includes industry representatives to weigh in on the pay of FAA employees. No, that was a concern for top FAA officials who said, we don't know how that's going to affect these employees. You know, this idea of, you know, asking the agency to, you know, provide proof if it wanted to take control away from companies, that really came from industry. And what the industry folks will say is, look, we worked really hard to be able to show the FAA that we have the capability to approve this stuff. And what we're seeing is that inspectors and, you know, FAA employees can make arbitrary decisions about when to take back control. And that uncertainty causes delays, causes frustrations, and it's not fair to us. You know, but what the FAA was saying is, okay, but this language goes a bit too far because the issue is now we're going to have to wait until a hazard has already been introduced onto an airplane. And right now I'm basically quoting from comments that were submitted to Congress from the FAA saying this essentially ties our hands too much. And so there was a vigorous debate, and it's not as if I think industry felt as though, you know, this was a reasonable thing to ask. It's just that, you know, a lot of there were FAA officials who felt differently.
Mike, you want to respond to that? Because I just wonder, there's a basic critique of older regulatory structures from the FAA, as Natalie was saying. Boeing says it was too slow. It was inefficient. It made them less competitive. I mean, does the FAA have enough inspectors and technicians and engineers to do the job that it needs to do.
No, that's one of the problems that we've been working on with the FAA is a staffing model to get a proper number. We don't know what that number is. I know Dan Elwell said that, you know, he's not going to hire 10,000 inspectors and ask Congress for $2 billion. But the bottom line for us is we know there's not enough inspectors out there to do the work that needed to be done. And the philosophy is they're non-essential personnel, which means the FAA decided themselves in 2013 inspector workforce is not essential to work when such things as a furlough that we just had. And they sat on the sidelines while the industry kept moving forward. Certain things, the way the FAA perceives the inspectors now are data collectors, like I said earlier. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with the new FAA administrator, Steve Dixon, I've worked with him for many years on the Next Gen Advisory Committee. I want to work with Steve to get his interpretation of trying to change the philosophy over there in FAA, because Steve's a pilot and he, I think, believes in safety is the number one goal, and to work with us to figure out, as the captain said, balancing off the inspector workforce. You know, in the past, before this accident occurred, we've had inspectors in the FAA removed from inspections because the industry would go to either the Hill or go to FAA upper management headquarters and say, this inspector is causing us delays, this inspector is causing us problems. And the FAA management would remove the inspector instead of siding with the inspector. The regulations are the regulations, the policies and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, what the industry says is the FAA is inconsistent sometimes with those regulations. Well, then let's fix the regulation and make it more plain, English kind of thing. But right. But that's been a problem.
Well, so, Natalie, we've just got a couple minutes left to go here. Just to sort of recap for folks, I mean, as your reporting has shown, as of late last year now, we have a regulatory situation in which industry, or I should say a panel of industry representatives, will help assess performance incentive policies for FAA employees. As Mike has been telling us, FAA inspectors are reliant on data given to them by Boeing or aviation companies. And as you've said, if they want to sort of put the brakes on something, at least a little bit, they have to call for an investigation versus just taking back oversight here. These are really big changes in terms of regulation on keeping aircraft safe. But some of the people who were grilling Dennis Muhlenberg just this week voted to pass this law. Are they having any second thoughts?
Yeah, they definitely are, Meghna. And that is that's a really good point. I mean, lawmakers on the Hill this week were in the kind of awkward position of criticizing a system that they helped create. And you know, we've heard from many of them. And, you know, Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut said to Mr. Muhlenberg, Boeing pushed for this. Boeing lobbied Congress for this, and now we need to take it back. So I think that for some lawmakers, there's a sense that something needs to be done, because really, to kind of take a step back, what we've seen is this system was not questioned, really, before these two accidents. It was seen as really just the obvious way of doing business. But two accidents have happened, 346 people have died, and when we look at what occurred, you know, these investigations are revealing that Boeing didn't fully explain how this plane worked to regulators. Regulators didn't have the expertise in place to really analyze what they were getting, and what fell through the holes is a system that ultimately became really dangerous. So there is an urgency right now, I think, in Congress in looking at what can be done to prevent this from happening again.
Well, Natalie Kitroev, reporter for The New York Times, covering aviation safety. We've got links to Natalie's terrific reporting on these regulatory issues at onpointradio.org. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike Perrone, national president of the Professional Aviation Safety Specialists, a union which represents FAA inspectors, technicians, engineers, and others, has worked for the FAA for more than 30 years. Mike Perrone, thank you so much for joining us, too.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.